Today is a pretty good day to have my first guest on. His name is Clint Van Zandt. He's the former FBI hostage negotiator who has written about his life in a book called Facing Down Evil. And I say it's a pretty good day to have him on only because there are two stories that probably seem like the sort of stuff he dealt with every day. First, we had a gunman in a black trench coat who opened fire Wednesday in the cafeteria of a college up in Montreal, Canada. Four dead, 16 injured there. And in Chicago, Illinois, or rather Dalton, Illinois, up near Chicago, we've got a gunman who's taken at least two people hostage during an attempted bank robbery. Clint, is this the sort of stuff that was a normal part of your day when you worked for the FBI?
Well, it was. These are the things, Paul, we just expected. I mean, that was always one of the interesting things about going to work, is that even though you got there, you never knew what your day was going to hold. I mean, for example, I'm sitting here in an NBC television studio right now up in Washington, D.C., and for the last 3 hours, I've been on television live talking about the situation you just mentioned, this shooting at a college in Montreal, Canada. It's kind of the equivalent, what you and I would call a junior or a community college, with upwards of four dead and 16 injured. And then, of course, the bank situation you're talking about, I mean, I have been involved in, as a FBI agent, investigator, and negotiator, in more bank robberies than I care to remember over the years, a number of them that did, in fact, turn into hostage situations where it was usually my responsibility to show up the bank and then figure out a way to get this person or these individuals to give up without killing anybody and, in fact, without killing themselves.
When you're dealing with situations like that, whether it's a bank robbery or another situation where you have to come in as a hostage negotiator, is there such a thing as a common theme?
Well, I think you've got to be careful to try a cookie-cutter approach, Paul. You can't say one theme fits all. You know, in my book, Facing Down Evil, one of the situations I talk about is what we thought to be a bank robbery in Rochester, New York, an individual holding multiple hostages inside the bank. What I didn't know is that just before going into the bank, he had killed his mother, he had killed a wallpaper hanger in his mother's house and critically wounded his stepfather. He went into that bank not to rob it, but he wanted to die. And his only demand was that I meet him in the parking lot and have a shootout with him. And as I continued to try to negotiate with him, realizing we couldn't get into the bank, he was barricaded in, we were trying to find a way to get him out. And as I kept trying to talk him out, he picked out one female hostage in the bank, stood her in front of a door, and blew her in half with a shotgun, blew her through the door, killed her. Then he calmly walked across the bank and stood in front of a window where he knew across the street we had a police sniper set up because he'd already shot at the sniper. And then he stands there and puts his head prone against a window, and our sniper obliged him, and shot him. But I went into that thinking we had a hostage barricade situation, and what it turned out to be is one of the first instances of suicide by cop in the United States. And I learned a terrible lesson, and people died because of it.
Yeah, and when you're in a situation like that, and that phrase suicide by cop or death by cop is one I've heard in situations like that, is there part of you that says, we're dealing with a killer here. We just saw what he did to that woman. At this point, we don't care about taking him into custody. We just want to blow him away, too.
Well, maybe not in those words, Paul, but I think, you have to reach a point where you say, if I can, in fact, talk this person out, if I can save other lives, maybe not have to commit law enforcement to go into the door where they may get shot, if I can save the life of other hostages, I'm going to do it. But other stories I talk about in my book is where I had to make that call. I had to say this person poses such a threat to the hostages that we are going to have to take them out. We're going, whatever buzzword, whether you want to do eliminate, neutralize, the reality is we're going to shoot him and kill him to save the life of other people. And somebody's got to make that call.
Talking with Clint Van Zandt, the former FBI hostage negotiator. His book is called Facing Down Evil, Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And we're going to talk about people like David Koresh and the situation at Waco and the Murrah Federal Building bombing in Oklahoma City and the Unabomber. But I'm always interested in process. That first-person stories and process stories are the ones that are most compelling to me. So I'm trying to, as I'm reading the book, I'm fascinated by you taking us inside the negotiation process. And I'm curious about whether, as an FBI hostage negotiator, you would ever negotiate with someone completely as a ruse, draw them out, lie to them about what you're promising them, that sort of stuff, because all that matters is having the situation end up well, and then you'll deal with the broken promises later. Is that part of it?
It can be, Paul, but I'm a pretty simple guy. I come from Granite City, Illinois. I went to Southern Illinois University. I have the Midwestern values that all of your listening audience, I share the same values because I grew up in the same area. And my position was always tell the truth. I didn't have to retreat from the truth. And the only time I would lie as like the British SAS, their equivalent to, say, U.S. Army Delta, they always speak about the only lie you tell is the last lie. And that's when you fear so much for the lives of the hostages that you have to get the hostage taker to come to the window and make sure the getaway car is positioned in the right place. Obviously, you get him to the window so the tactical team can take him out. I've had to put people in that position. If somebody says you told a lie, you know what, Paul, they've got me. And I would do what I had to do to save the life of everybody. But I realized that the hostages didn't put themselves in that position. And if somebody's going to get injured on my watch, it's not going to be a hostage. It's not going to be a cop. It's not going to be a civilian. It's going to be the guy who put himself in that position. Give me the opportunity, and I will get everybody out alive. And, Paul, that's not macho. That's not, gold around my neck being macho. That's just saying that's the cold, hard reality, as you read in the book, of when, those situations, if you're right, you're right. Everybody packs up and goes home. And if you're wrong, somebody dies. And I've had enough people die around me over 25 years that, some of those images, you carry them forever.
In that quarter century doing this as for a living, and, you're right, that is the job. Get things done, get everybody out, get everybody home safely to their families. That's got to be the goal every day, and you were darn good at it. What do most of the people you're dealing with on the other side, the hostage takers, want? Is it, for the most part, they want to get out of there safely, and do they actually believe they can get away with what they've done?
Well, part of my job is to help minimize what they've done, to help convince them. I mean, I've said to people, hey, you haven't done anything so bad. All you wanted to do was borrow some money from a bank. Somebody, you just didn't sign the loan papers. That's not that big a deal.
Uh-huh.
I will minimize, and I'll have, because people don't want to believe they're bad. They don't want to believe they're going to jail for life. They want to believe something's good is going to happen to them. It's my job to emphasize the positive and de-emphasize the negative. As a negotiator, I create a psychological umbilical cord, just like between a mother and a child. I create that psychological cord between myself and the hostage taker, and everything good passes back and forth. I have to get that person to look at me, believe what I say, listen to what I say, and go along with me. And many times I hold a mirror up to them, kind of a, look, is this how you want to be seen, and how do you want this situation to be resolved? I can help you resolve it with nobody else getting hurt.
And what wouldn't you give up as a negotiator?
Well, I mean, I've had people in one case, in a barricade bank robber, he said, I want an M16 and 500 rounds of ammunition. Well, I'm not going to give him any more guns than he has, but I said, an M16 is a military weapon. I said, when I was in Vietnam, I was an agent in Army Intelligence, I carried an M16. Guy said, yeah, I was in Vietnam, too. And I said, when I was in Vietnam, I was wounded one time. I was hit by a grenade fragment. And the guy says, yeah, I was wounded multiple times in Vietnam. Well, all of a sudden, we got two Vietnam War vets sitting on the phone talking back and forth about being wounded. This guy had been a tunnel rat, had gone down into VC tunnels trying to find them, had been snake bit, had been shot a couple of times, got hooked on morphine, got out of the military, came back to the United States, still on drugs, started robbing banks and other places. So as I'm talking to him about Vietnam, and obviously if I can get somebody talking, they're not killing anybody. They're listening to me. And as we listened, I got a federal prosecutor, an assistant United States attorney, called him, got him to the scene. I said, hey, can I make a deal? Can I offer this guy, if he gives up, nobody else hurt, part of his sentence will be to send him to a federal drug rehabilitation program. The assistant United States attorney says, if that'll get him out, I'll make the deal. I turned around and made the deal with a guy. He laid down his gun, he let the hostages, and he walked out of the bank.
Nice job. Nice job. And getting to know them and getting to know what they're like and understanding their history, led you to then go on to be a behavioral profiler. In fact, you were the supervisor at Quantico. Was the Scott Glenn character in Silence of the Lambs modeled after you?
No, it wasn't. It was modeled after others. I can't. I know there are some profilers who fight for the term serial killer and who fight for the character in Silence of the Lambs. They can have that. I mean, I did my job. It was, they used my office when they filmed Silence of the Lambs. In fact, they came down when they filmed it, and they wanted to do it right in the behavioral science unit, but they didn't like the color of the walls. They said they're too government color. So they came in. They came in one day, Paul. They repainted the halls in my office. They shot the movie, and then they painted them back the government colors again and left.
Wait a minute. They're in a government office, and they don't like the color because it's too government. But they're making a movie about a government office.
But we weren't fashion conscious enough, Paul. The colors weren't right.
That's classic. Let's talk about some of the infamous cases you worked on, and we'll start with 1993, the Branch Davidians, Waco, David Koresh. How do you talk sense as a negotiator with a crazy man?
Well, in that case, I was sent to Waco about 2 weeks into it. I had already gone into the behavioral science unit. I was doing psychological profiling of serial killers. And when Waco went down, my first thought was, you know, I've done enough of these over the years. Part of me was glad it wasn't on my watch anymore. And about a week and a half or 2 weeks went by, and I got the call saying, we want you to go down. We want you to take over the negotiations there. You know, Paul, sometimes things are broke, and you can't go in and fix them. And there were things that had been done that I didn't agree with. Doesn't make me right, wrong, or indifferent. I just didn't agree with the way things were done. But I know once we got, when I got to Waco and over that time period, almost 2 months, we had about 850 individual contacts with the Branch Davidians. 850 times the negotiators asked the Branch Davidians to, let's resolve this, let's surrender, let's come out. You know, I mean, Waco could fill up books, and it has filled up books of, you know, was the government right or wrong? Was the FBI right or wrong? I mean, was Janet Reno make the right decision? Those, we, you know, I'm comfortable talking about, but it takes forever. But as far as talking to them, there came a night when David Koresh wanted to talk to a Christian FBI agent. Now, you know, I'm not a proselytizer, whatever one's religious belief is, so be it. But, you know, I went to a church in Granite City. I grew up there, and I was very comfortable in my own personal belief system. And even though I was running the negotiations teams, which means you normally take a step back, you let other people negotiate, one night, I remember in particular, David Koresh and I were on the phone for about 2 or 3 hours, and he would race through the Bible, and I had my Bible, and he had his, and he would take me to different places in the Bible, try to explain to me why he was doing what he was doing, try to explain to me why he had the right to have sexual contact with pre-teenage girls, try to explain to me why he had the right to tell every man in his compound that only David Koresh could have intimate physical contact with the wives, that the husbands could no longer do that. And I would keep finding fault in his philosophy, and David Koresh would say, he called me Brother Clint, which still kind of rings in my ear, Paul. He'd say, Brother Clint, do you know who I am? And I said, you know, David, who do you think you are? And he says, no, do you know who I am? He says, I am the Christ. Well, you know, I was waiting for the lightning bolts to hit him, and unfortunately they didn't. But I said, David, you know, you may believe that, but when I read the Bible, it talks about Christ doing what he can to save one lost sheep, and you're talking about seeing your whole flock slaughtered. And he said, well, Brother Clint, you know, basically we're going to do what we got to do. And as that situation progressed, I just saw David Koresh as someone who was just, in some small ways, he was delusional that he wasn't going to come out of there. When I said, David, you know, come on out and I'll take care and I'll make sure that, you know, you've got a good attorney and representation, he says, oh, no, Brother Clint. He says, you bring me out, you're going to put me in the jail in Texas with Bubba. And he says, you know what Bubba's going to do to me? Well, Koresh knew he was a child molester, and he knew that that's the lowest rung on the ladder inside of a prison. And I said, no, David, I will guarantee you your own private room. You won't have to share. You won't have to do it with anybody else. But Koresh wasn't coming out, and about a week and a half before Waco went down, before the fire, before all those losses, I wrote an analysis to the FBI, and I said, Koresh's master plan is to force the FBI to assault the Davidian compound, and when we do, the Davidians will blow it up, burn it down, there will be a mass suicide, and the FBI will be absolutely responsible, and we will all share in the loss of those people. And a week and a half later, I saw the FBI make a decision to put gas in, and even though I know that the Branch Davidians set 3 different fires inside that compound, I believe the FBI poured the emotional kerosene on that fire by the way we went about that situation. And, Paul, it's one thing if adults make a decision to commit suicide, to die. So, you know, so be it. They make that decision. It's a bad decision. But when they make the decision and the lives of all those children were lost, and Koresh would send me a video once a week or so with him with a different child, a two or three children sitting on his lap, and he would say certain things to me. I would watch the video to try to get inside Koresh's head, but what I got to do was know every one of those children by name, and when they died, when that fire happened, part of me died.
Listening to you tell the story, all I'm thinking about is those children, and that must have been uppermost in your mind as you're trying to negotiate with him, because part of it was supposed to be about the arms cache that the Branch Davidians had in their compound and which Koresh had exclusive control over. But there also had to be a big part of you saying, I got to save these kids.
That was it. It was, you adults make the decisions you want to, but let me get those kids out. The kids can't decide to stay in this location. They can't decide to have their life perhaps taken by that. And even though we negotiated some children out, what we came to find out is that they were children that were not any descendant of David Koresh's. Any of the children that were related to him that he had fathered, those children stayed, and those children died.
Where were you in the chain of command under Janet Reno? How much power does a hostage negotiator have on a scene like that?
Well, I've had more in the past, I can tell you. In this particular situation, the on-scene commander, the FBI agent in charge, the tactical team, the FBI tactical team really had his ear. And, you know, and they could have been right, Paul. You know, they could have been right. The tactical team position was that if we put enough pressure on the Branch Davidians, if we keep squeezing that compound, if we put gas in that building, they're all going to run from there. They'll all throw down their guns and surrender. And I said, I don't think that's going to break them. I said, I think it's going to squeeze them together. I think it's going to drive them together, almost like a nuclear explosion where you have an implosion and then an explosion. And I had to make my case to the on-scene commander, but, you know, he made some decisions that the tactical resolution sounded better to him. And I never got a chance to take a run at Janet Reno. Never got a chance to talk to her. I mean, in 2020 hindsight, I wish I would have jumped on a plane, flew to Washington, D.C., pounded on her door and said, Attorney General, we can't do this. We're going to be responsible for the death of these people. But, you know, I wasn't bright enough, I guess.
Also, the FBI wasn't set up for you to do that. There was that chain of command, and you had to follow that, right?
Yeah, there was, but you know, I was still there, and I was still part of that. And you know, I've had people over the years call me a baby killer and a baby burner. And you know, I've got three kids, I've got grandkids. I mean, I would have given my life to save the children in that compound, and it just didn't work.
Could you have gotten Koresh to give up if the tactical team hadn't taken over?
I don't know. You know, one of the things I suggested, I said, hey, you know, there's already been a shootout with ATF and the Branch Davidians. There are dead people on both sides. You know, we've got all the cameras in the world, media sitting here, Koresh is relishing in this media. They said, what do you want to do? And I said, let's pull everybody out. Let's pull FBI out, ATF out. Let's put an 18-foot tall chain link fence around the Branch Davidian compound. We'll have gates in the front. We'll have buses parked there with the engines running. We'll give the Branch Davidians a video that shows the motel that the FBI has rented where the family members are going to go and stay until this whole situation is resolved. We're going to give them a picture of tomorrow. Psychologically, I wanted them to know that their world didn't have to end on that windswept piece of land in Waco, Texas. I wanted them to know there would be a tomorrow, and the FBI said, we're not going to do that.
What was your role in the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City investigation, Clint?
You know, it started out very small. It eventually moved to being part of the investigative team that handled the whole situation. But I went to work that morning, the morning of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. I walked in my office and had on cable news and saw that the bombing had taken place. And about the same time I'm looking at the explosive footprint on that building, I get a call from FBI headquarters. And I say, hey, you're the only profiler we can get a hold of at this time. They said, we're looking for a working profile of who would have done this. I mean, the smoke was still in the air. I mean, they were still trying to retrieve bodies. And I said, that's easy. I said, you know, today is the two-year anniversary of Waco. I said, I was at Waco. I know what took place there. I said, it's not a coincidence that this happened 2 years to the date. So I said, let's reverse engineer. If, in fact, it's someone who is angry, who did it to happen on the same date 2 years later as Waco, I said, it's going to be a white male. He's going to be in his mid-20s. He's going to be former military. That's going to show his knowledge of weapons and explosives. He's not going to be married. He probably doesn't have a girlfriend. I said he's going to do it with maybe one or two other people at most. And the reason he's doing it is because he's angry. He's seething at the U.S. government as to what happened at Waco. He wants to make a statement about the overages of government, and this is the way he's making a statement. And I remember the FBI agent from headquarters I was speaking to at the time, he said, well, you know, we appreciate that, but he said, we think this has got the footprint of like a bombing in Beirut or someplace in the Middle East, and we've got a guy who just hopped on a plane out of Oklahoma City heading back to Egypt. We're going to intercept that plane, pull that guy off. We think it was a Middle Eastern terrorist. Well, that's one of those, you get what you pay for, you know. But I say, thank God for that Oklahoma City state trooper who just did his job. You know, he wasn't in there for the honor, for the glory. He was out doing his job. The bombing had taken place. And he sees Timothy McVeigh drive by with a license plate hanging by one bolt. And he does what every cop in this country does, which is just his or her normal job. He pulls the car over. He finds out that Timothy McVeigh is carrying a gun. He arrests him. He sticks him in jail. And it took about a day, day and a half for the FBI to put together that Ryder truck that had been used that hauled the explosive and trace it back to Timothy McVeigh. And it was just a matter of maybe hours at most between the FBI finally identifying McVeigh and McVeigh getting off on those charges of carrying a concealed weapon and getting away. So, you know, the FBI did a good job on the case. I was part of the entire investigative process after that point. But like so many other cases, they're not solved by super profilers or anything else. Usually they're solved by information from citizens or just ordinary cops doing their job.
But, you know, the FBI officials above you who made that call to go after the Egyptian, they were not the only ones who were thinking, well, this has got to be Islamic fundamentalists. I mean, it was only a couple of years after the first bombing of the World Trade Center. And while we didn't have the focus on that kind of terrorism that we certainly do in a post-9/11 world, was that an unreasonable assumption on their part, do you think?
Well, I think they were going on the information they had. We saw radical Islamic fundamentalism rearing its ugly head. I mean, you know, I don't want to make a political statement, but I think our country has been at war with radical Islamic fundamentalism since the 80s. We just haven't acknowledged that. So I think it was logical for the FBI to look at it, but I had spent years dealing with domestic terrorist groups that were trying to develop weapons of mass destruction. We dealt with one group down in Bull Shoals, Arkansas area, that when we finally arrested that whole group, known as CSA, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, when we finally took them in another Waco-type situation, but you didn't hear a whole lot about that because as a negotiator, we talked everybody into surrendering, and all the men, women, and children came out. When we went in to search that compound, we found a 55-gallon barrel of cyanide. I asked one of the members, what were you going to do with that? And he kind of smiled, and he said, we were going to take it to Chicago and pour it in the water supply because we were going to kill African-Americans, blacks. I said, well, you know, excuse me, but, you know, whites, blacks, yellows, browns, we all drink out of the same water. And he says, yeah, but he said it was our plan to get as many blacks as we could. So when you've got that type of thinking going on, it's not too hard to move one click down the line to say that someone with a similar type of mindset would be capable of setting that bomb off, especially that anniversary with Waco would be much more significant to someone who was a real white right-wing anti-government person than someone who was a Middle Eastern terrorist.
And today, of course, we have that continued attention being paid to international terrorists, Islamic fundamentalists, and what they could do here. Have we taken our eye off the domestic terrorist ball? Is there still a big threat there?
I think the threat exists, but I think there's a lot of people who are, you know, quasi-domestic terrorists who kind of consider themselves quasi-patriots that may have made some type of pledge or plan that, you know, as long as we're engaged in this war against fundamental terrorists overseas, you know, maybe we won't engage here. But you got to realize the ultimate plan of radical Islamic fundamentalism, I mean, they want to eliminate Israel as a country. They want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. There's a lot of people that subscribe to the far right-wing, neo-Nazi, paramilitary, religious fundamentalists, whatever you want to call them, who believe that the Israelis that are the ones that are pulling the strings of all the banks, that they're involved in secret plots. I mean, you know, Americans like to believe plots, whether it's the U.S. Navy shot down, you know, a TWA 800, or whether it was the Air Force that actually bombed the Mural Federal Building. It wasn't Timothy McVeigh. It was F-16s that dropped bombs on it. I mean, there are people who want to hate their government, who want to believe government's in conspiracy. I don't buy those theories. The idea, no, it's not that what you couldn't have a rogue person do something wrong. It's that there is not enough people in the government who could keep their mouth shut and not say that there was a conspiracy if it did exist.
Clint, you spent your entire adult life profiling bad guys, and now you work in security. Since leaving the FBI 10 years ago, you're in the corporate security field and private security as well. Let's combine those and tell me what you think of profiling at airport security.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely necessary. Let's talk about Logan International Airport in Boston, for example. Logan is one of the key areas where they have used behavioral profiling. Now, realize I use the term behavior. It doesn't have to do with whether you're from the Middle East, whether you're young, whether you're old, whether you've got a shawl wrapped around or a towel wrapped around or anything else wrapped around your head. It's got nothing to do with religious preference or color or skin. It says if we see certain type of behavior, that should be a key to us to ask some more questions. Hi, how are you? Where are you going today? Who are you going to see? You know, if somebody comes up to me, where are you going? Yeah, you know, I'm flying to St. Louis. What are you going to do? I'm going to see my mother and spend some time with her. I've got those answers. If a member of TSA asks those questions and they get a blank stare, that should be a clue. You know, you don't have to be an FBI agent to say that's a clue. And in Logan, at Logan's airport in Boston, in the last year, by using behaviorally oriented profiling, they have arrested 100 individuals who are either carrying and smuggling drugs, who have phony passports, who have phony driver's license, who have some type of weapon stashed in their bag. 100 times they've had hits. Now, are you going to have false positives? Yes. You know, and I tell you what, if they come and they ask me a question and I have the wrong answer and they say, excuse me, Mr. Van Zandt, you have to stand over here. We're going to run the wand over you again. We're going to go through your bag before you get on the plane. Go to it. You know, do what you got to do to make the plane that I'm going to get on safe. And to take away behavioral profiling for the ACLU or whoever they are or he or she is or whatever organization who says that's targeted against any one individual, race, creed, that's wrong. And if you take away that weapon, behaviorally oriented profiling, you take away one of our last abilities to stop a repeat from 9/11.
Yeah, I agree. I wish there were more of that behavioral profiling going on and not the other kinds that are being done, which I think are a problem. But we'll have to talk about that some other time. Clint, I know you got to run and do more MSNBC. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Clint Van Zandt, his book is Facing Down Evil, Life on the Edge as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. This is the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.